All right, I see it is 1 o'clock here on the Eastern Coast, so I think it'd be great if we go ahead and get started. Welcome everyone to InfoSec Props Red Team ANA. I'm super stoked to have all of you guys here. I'm Cybersecurity Meg, in case you don't know me, and the irony of me hosting this is that I am through and through a blue teamer, but today we're going to have some fun discussing everything about red teaming. We have some of the most brilliant people in the defensive security business here with us. We have Al, we have Crab, we have Siren, we have Husky Hacks. So all the questions you guys have submitted, we're gonna go ahead and go through them. We're gonna limit today's AMA to about an hour and a half maximum just because of time constraints and to be respectful of everyone's time. But let's go ahead and get into it. I want to start with the first question, and let's start off with Al. Al's our server owner here, so it seems like a great place to start. If anyone else, panelist-wise, has an answer to it, feel free to chime in. I think you all are going to bring a lot of brilliant information to it, so let's just go for it. First question: how does red teaming differ from general pen testing, and why do you enjoy it?
That's a good question to start off with. First of all, thank you for that sterling introduction, Meg. I appreciate it. Hello, everybody. Okay, so how does red teaming differ? So this is a very commonly misunderstood thing, especially with people who are only cursorily familiar with the cybersecurity community. A lot of people think that they understand these things, and they really don't. They use red team as more of a general as a general term to refer to all to all. Offensive security sort of positions, which gets confusing sometimes. But to a red teamer, what it means is, it put simply, you're LARPing as a criminal. You're pretending to be an adversary, an APT, a cyber criminal, an advanced threat actor of some kind, and you're. Sometimes you are actually purposefully taking on a particular adversary's tactics. In order to imitate them and see how an organization best responds to that particular adversary. So it very specifically hones in on not necessarily finding vulnerabilities, but acting as a real threat would in the real world. I enjoy it just because I want to be I want to be a criminal. I want to be Ocean's 11. I want to do heists. But I really don't want to go to jail. So this is a good fit for me. It's a good middle ground.
Yeah, and I think if anyone has seen Al on Twitch, we all know exactly how much he loves pretending to be the bad guy. So I totally get that. Crab, Siren, Husky Hacks, do either of you guys have kind of an explanation about why you love red teaming that you'd like to go into?
I can take that. I'd also like to start by saying thank you for that incredible introduction, and it's a very kind appraisal of my abilities, and probably a wrong appraisal of my abilities. I'm not a genius. I'm not a brilliant red teamer, but that's very kind of you, Meg. Thank you for saying that. Red teaming's the idea, the job of a red team is to challenge the assumptions made by an organization about their technical their tech stack or their processes and procedures when it relates to technology, specifically from the opinion and the perspective of the adversary. So what this generally ends up looking like, and Al covered this pretty well, but a company will say, we're moving everything to the cloud. It's going to be great. We're going to have all this availability and nothing's ever going to go wrong again. And the red team steps in and says, hold on a second. We're going to test these assumptions. We're going to test your assumptions about, are you secure if you move things to the cloud? We're going to test the assumptions about, do the people you think have access to these resources actually have access to these resources? And we're going to test your assumption about, if you put your precious, precious data up in the cloud and that walks out the door, how damaging is that going to be to your company? We role play as general scary adversary, kid in the basement, nation state hacker, cyber criminal. We could take on the characteristics of a specific advanced persistent threat, or we can just kind of take an amalgamation of a bunch of different tactics, techniques, and procedures, put that all together, and present threat that way. So at the end of the day, you're looking at an organization from the eyes of an adversary and trying to test their assumptions about what their technology, what they think about their technology.
Yeah, I totally agree there. So again, as far as I'm concerned, thank you for the introduction. Certainly glad to be here. As far as red teaming is concerned, I think actually Husky and Alhazred have already put it very well. For me, I think the biggest drive behind red teaming is going to be essentially, yes, mimicking the a threat actor, an actor of malicious intent, to essentially mitigate or compromise pre-existing security controls that exist for either, they could be federal organizations, corporate organizations, it could be data center, it just depends where you're going to be. But you're going to be trying to mitigate these security controls. And then the next thing you're going to be doing is a game of patience. One thing I've not really heard too much here is how much patience you have to have in red teaming. We've sat inside organizations before for years, just before we could demonstrate like a full capability, like a gambit of capabilities. And also going for maximum impact. For example, if we were able to get into your organization's, let's say, credit data, so we actually had access to the main credit line that was pulling back and ordering, I don't know, from a steel mill, we could redirect that, and instead of your organization having, you know, so many tons of steel delivered, we could show impact as to how we could have placed an order for, you know, 5, maybe 10 million mechanical pencils, and how that could have showed up in the cargo of some train, rather than the steel, and or you know, what would your organization like what would be of the most impact if you lost it for 24 hours? Those types of things, and going for that maximum level of impact, just to demonstrate, you know, why we're still there, why we're persistent in nature, like an APT, an advanced persistent threat, why we're persistent, and you know, how low traffic we can be, how we can sit there for long periods of time, and maybe even potentially compromise other organizations. There are some cases that I really love about red teaming where we actually get to stay once the engagement is even over, just staying and monitoring, say, like a private system or like a test environment, just to be able to check the network and check our capabilities at that existing time. And then if any APTs existed, we could bring it to their awareness, or we could show how another organization could have fallen, and that would be very bad, you know, for organization A that we were in. So as far as those things are concerned, like that's just pretty much that's pretty much how I'd wrap that up.
The goals, the goals between the two types of assessments are completely different. One, you're looking at a case study of kind of like the security posture over X amount of time, right? But when you're involved with red teaming, it insinuates that there's a blue team looking for you. So you may not be concerned with getting caught on a penetration test, but it matters a lot on a red team because it asserts a judgment on the organization for their ability to detect and respond to a threat. So I would maybe contextualize it like that.
It's a bit more of a chess match, or even like a Go match, if you guys, not the Go the language, but Go the board game, if you guys have played Go. It's a longer term, more building out capabilities against an opponent and trying to outmaneuver and outsmart them. Then compared to something like a penetration test. The other thing I wanted to bring up, and this is a very specific interview question sometimes when you get asked if you're applying for a red team operator position. The interview question might be something like, can you please explain the difference between a pen test and a red team engagement in a practical, technical, like in the weeds sense, or maybe more specific than just kind of the ideas. So something practical that you could respond in that case, and I think it kind of summarizes it, is that if a pen tester is doing a web application assessment against a company and they find some web application vulnerability like insufficient encryption, a pen tester will say, that's a vulnerability. We're going to write that down. We're going to put that in the report. It's not a very high rated vulnerability, but we're going to put that in the report and submit it. Fix this when you can. A red teamer, unless they can perform activity on the objective, so meaning that they've received their orders of what they're trying to actually compromise, and the objective is to perform that, if that insufficient encryption vulnerability can't be used to leverage and perform activities on the objective, the red team operator is not going to care about that. They're not even going to probably put that in the report if they find that. Now, if they find a remote code execution vulnerability in this web app and that launches them right into the target infrastructure, you bet that's going to go in the report because they were able to leverage that, pivot that into further activity on the objective. That, to me, that is a kind of technical, practical example of how the two approaches are different. One cares about all the vulnerabilities, no matter how small they may be or their likelihood of being exploited, and one is really objective-oriented, taking an objective, trying to maneuver and use the vulnerabilities to actually extract data, or maybe deface a website, or maybe throw a comment in the front page of the organization that says, hey, I was here, or something like that. Something that shows that you are actually able to use that to affect.
Great. Thank you, everyone, so much for those wonderful explanations. We're only 10 minutes into this, and Husky Hacks has already thrown out the word amalgamation, so I feel like this is going to go really, really swell for the rest of the night. So our second question, I want to limit it to just one or two responses because I feel like it's a much more succinct and direct question. But essentially, it's asking, have the recent supply chain attacks that have been going on, for instance, all the SolarWinds shenanigans that we're familiar with, have those kind of attacks changed everything in terms of your clients' expectations or scopes of your engagements? So whoever feels like they might be best prepared to answer that question, please go ahead and feel free to do so.
I'm just going to come in here and actually just say no. It's not affected really anything. If anything, it's brought out attention to a very important matter like asset reliance. The amount of assets that you have centralized at one location. That was just a really bad example of how, you know, so many high-profile organizations had their assets, and they were reliant with those assets at one particular organization, right? And as far as red teaming is concerned with that kind of thing, that's the kind of stuff that, you know, we would go for anyway. We'd go for showing and demonstrating, hey, look, here was a, you know, we discovered this piece of code, and we were able to gain access to, say, a development server. We want to show you that, hey, we found credentials for that you were pushing to this other organization. And we found your deployment scripts, and we just want to let you know we could completely, if we were a real threat actor, and so on and so forth. If we were truly malicious, we could have done this. We could have moved more laterally across an infrastructure standpoint or from an infrastructure standpoint and even affected your own stakeholders as an organization, your own clients that you work with. So I think it's brought attention to it, but has it directly changed the name of the game? Absolutely not. I don't think so.
I would agree with that.
Go ahead, Husky.
No, you got it, man. Go ahead.
I'll just say very quickly that, with every single one of these high-profile breaches and like the Colonial Pipeline thing, all the CEOs go, oh my God, how can we prevent that from happening? And then the security guys all go, okay, well, we're going to need a bigger budget and we're going to need to do this, this, and this, and this. And they're like, ooh, that's going to cost money. Oh, I'm gonna have to pass on that one, and that happens every single time. Like it's a repeat, it's a constantly repeating pattern. And I have an example of a supply chain related thing, but it's too long of a story to tell in this context. But perhaps I will if people want to hear it later when we have time. Go ahead, Husky.
So yeah, I was gonna say it has changed the approach to red teaming. I think very little. Supply chain compromise has always been in the game. It's not a new method of exploitation. What it has changed is kind of what Al was alluding to, the response from leadership. When that comes across their desk, they take a look and say, oh no, how they in leadership will immediately imagine the worst case scenario and say, how can we prevent something like this? Well, the way you prevent something like this is kind of, it's a long and drawn out and intense conversation. So yeah, it's a little more different than when the leadership thinks, you know, we're going to solve this immediately. So that part I think is different, but, and the more of these big high profile kind of supply chain attacks, not necessarily ransomware, but supply chain attacks, the more that it happens, the more the leadership responds to it. Right. But from the red team perspective, it's very much the same as it's been. That is one of the, maybe I would consider five major ways that companies get compromised. It always has been. It's been around for a while, and it's not really going away anytime soon. It's probably only going to get worse.
Great points. You know, for some perspective, I work in incident response, and we always say that the best way to prevent an incident is to have an incident, because it's only when you have that major incident that you start getting the resources, the money, the tools that you actually need to prevent further incidents from happening. So I think that really goes along with what Husky and Al were saying. To my crustacean friend, Crab, I have a question for you. What would you say is the average length of your normal red team engagements? How long are they usually? How long are they taking you? What's that typically look like?
Take, so especially if you're already a pen tester looking to get into red teaming, take any expectation that you have of engagement length and throw it out the window.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might have some that are like a couple hours long. You might have some that are a year long. You have some that might be longer than that. You just, it's really hard to gauge that.
Yeah, and especially I'd say, aside from just pen testing, there's 184 people in here right now, and that number is climbing. I'd say if any of you work in application security, which is a growing field for penetration testers to just drop straight into the AppSec level of privileged access, constant, you know, testing, a little bit like Rambo with a machine gun, right? That's like very, very short durations, very repetitive kind of stuff. You can take all those preconceived notions of testing versus red teaming and just throw them out the window, man. Because those engagements last what? What did Husker say? Or Husky say? He said like, you know, a couple hours. Yeah, it can be a couple hours, it can be a week, or it can go for years.
As my colleagues have pointed out, it's going to vary a lot. My team has a rule that we try to emulate threat on a longer timeline. So 4 months is actually in a perfect world, the like platonic ideal of our operations would be 4 month operations. Does it ever work out that way? I'm not sure about that. But it, like Siren alluded to earlier, threat actors have years, like literal years, to develop capabilities in an environment. The longer you can get a block of time and say we're going to emulate over this block of time, hopefully that kind of translates to a higher quality of representation of the threat. But there's really no hard and fast rule about how long red teams are going to try to perform activities on the objective. Hours or months, maybe years. It's very much up in the air, and it depends on what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, most of us blue teamers are only working 40 to 50 hours a week, you know, while these advanced threat actors are spending years. So you can see why incidents happen, eh?
Yep.
So moving on to another question. And again, one or two people who want to answer this, stand forward. The question is there any software development in red teaming? And the examples that the question asker gives, they specifically cite creation of custom tooling, custom malware, etc. So any kind of software development that you guys are doing specifically for red teaming?
I'd say a resounding yes to that, at least in my shop.
Yeah, I got a little project I'm working on right now to prepare for the CRTO exam.
Definitely, just because of the organization I work for, I have to be very careful about some of these
questions. Yeah, same here. I got to be.
You know what I mean?
Very
lightly. You know what I mean? These are some very direct questions, man. So if I ever decline to comment, audience, I am so sorry. But as far as tooling goes, man, I mean, what do we encourage at OFSEC? We encourage that people make their own tools. We encourage that people, you know, delve deep into a technology or into a protocol, into reversing, debugging, whatever it might be, to further their knowledge and be more effective as a penetration tester in general. But I think I'll definitely just conclude on that one.
I can speak in kind of general terms, because there are things I do at work that I absolutely will not talk about here, and there are things I do in my personal time little projects like Al was talking about. Software development, if you're a red teamer that does not program or code, or it's something that you haven't approached yet, I would strongly, strongly recommend, or if you're interested in getting into the field, I strongly, strongly recommend that you start to pick up a language, if not a few. And I can give you some recommendations. If I am what I like to call doing things around the house, meaning that on my operator laptop or on my VMs that are operator side, not anything in the actual target environment, I will use Python extensively to automate, to set up tools, to set up unit tests. Python is just fantastic for that, right? That's why I like to say it's my doing things around the house kind of language. I would never, ever, ever write anything in Python and drop it into the environment, like compile it into one of those kind of like Python to executable thing. I'd never do that.
But really? I did.
You did?
Man, yeah, let's fight me.
Absolute madman. So I would not do that. Python around the house. Now you start to, when you leave the wire of your own operator laptop, I like to keep it to a few particular languages. If I'm building malware or capabilities that are going to be run in memory, C# is my go-to, so that I can run it, I can construct something in the .NET framework and invoke it as a reflective assembly, right? I can explain a little bit. If anybody is wondering what that is, I can expound a little bit. In-memory C# tooling will get you a lot of mileage. Dropping to disk, my absolute darling language that I've been using lately is NIM. NIM is a fantastic language, and if you're going to be constructing payloads that are dropping to disk, I would recommend that you look at it. It has the ease of a Python syntax with the compilation capability of producing executables that are compiled down to, you know, native C, right? They interact very, very strong interactions with the Windows 32 API. It's just it's a joy to write in. It produces fantastic executables that you can drop in, and it's just infinitely weaponizable. And I gotta shout out Bytebleeder here, who put together the offensive NIM repo, and I have that thing bookmarked, and I go back to it almost on a daily basis now. There's so much good stuff in that repo on GitHub. So go check that out, the offensive NIM repo by Bytebleeder. So to summarize, scripting things on my own operator laptop for automation and things, Python, running in memory, weaponization for running in memory, C#, and drop weaponization for dropping to disk, NIM.
Great. Thank you so much. I have a really important question, I think, that's going to be helpful for majority of the audience here. So let's dive right into that. Crustacean friend, can you please let me know, are there any particular things you can do to increase the chances of your success as a red teamer?
I'm going to sound probably really not kind, but by default, I have the advantage the second the engagement starts. Nothing I do has to go into change control. I don't have to tell anybody anything that I'm doing in the environment once I've landed. By default, I have the advantage by not being obligated to tell anybody else what I'm doing on the engagement. I mean, as long as I'm within the confines of the scope and communicating findings to the white cell, or what you would think of as kind of like the rule makers of the engagement, as long as I'm staying within the confines of the scope, I have the advantage by default. There's nothing else I need to do. I just need to do my best to attack an organization, figure out what the problem areas are, and write up my reports. There's not a whole lot I need to do to increase my chances.
Great. Anyone else who has any comments on that and how to be successful as a red teamer?
Yeah.
Increasing your chances of being successful, rather.
Yeah. So increasing your chances of being successful as a red teamer, emphasis on team and teamwork. So when it comes to being successful, there are a number of things that I have found in the past, even before I was with offensive security, that led to more success often than not. And that was having like a plan of attack or a pen and paper attack campaign out ahead of time with the team, where we were all very much on the same page with what our jobs were, our roles were, and our central notation platforms, our communication platforms, for convenience, having encrypted mobile chat, having or mobile data, right? For when you're on site or on prem. And also when we're doing the majority of our work, which would be from an external perspective, you know, your quarterly, biannual, annual assessment type stuff, that's just happening from the outside. Having a central location for your team, like a wiki or a private wiki, to be able for each, almost programmatically for each organization, so that your whole team is on the same page with the information you've collected, current attack vectors, you know, what we're working on today. It's not too much different than a regular job in that sense, that, you know, a good team is going to have their, okay, here's what I'm focusing on today. Here's what, you know, this person's focusing on today, and this person. And then you guys kind of rotate out roles. Rotating roles keeps your minds fresh. It keeps you, like, I don't know how to put this one, but my old boss for my old red team was an ex-Navy SEAL. So he was very militaristic in his approach. And he had us kind of rotating out roles, almost on a daily basis. That could be one organization, another organization, or what we're focusing on. But rotating out your roles, having central notation platforms, encrypted communication platforms that are burned, both for mobile and for, that is to say, on-prem and for your daily, you know, engagements, that kind of thing is going to be really useful.
Great. Thank you so much to everyone. I think those are really helpful answers. This next question is a little bit more spicy, so prepare yourselves. And that question is, and I'm hoping everyone can get a minute or two to go through their answer, what is something you dislike about red teaming? Unless you just want to tell us that you absolutely love red teaming and your entire career is perfect, you can definitely do that. But otherwise, what do you hate? What pisses you off? What frustrates you? Let's talk about it.
Red teaming is perfect. There's nothing that I dislike about it.
Yep.
That's mildly what I figured. Joking. And I don't want to speak to anything that's going to land me in hot water, but you should maybe, when you're going into a red team position, take a close look at your potential coworkers. Do they have the same skill sets as you? Do they have skill sets that could complement yours? Is there maybe an area where you shine that they don't? How do you complement each other? Or how does the team complement each other, right? So when you take it a step further and you flip the coin around, people will likely be what you dislike most about red teaming. And that's just a part of life.
Yeah. Crab, I just want you to know that you always shine in my heart. So let's just put that out there. That was important.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm piggybacking on that. I hate scoping. I understand it's what, separates us from the bad guys. I understand that's a necessary evil, but a lot of my clients try to put more like extraneous restrictions on me that not only make my job much harder, which is frustrating because I want my job to be easy, but also like bad guys are not bound by any such restrictions, and it leads me to the belief that this organization doesn't really want a red team. They want to say they had a red team engagement, but put so many restrictions on it that it's essentially meaningless. And then they can go to their bosses and say, look, we're so secure that the red teamers didn't find anything. So that becomes an issue with some clients. With other clients, the scope is, honestly, it's almost too open. Like that, you don't have enough time to do the engagement. It's too short. And yet there's so much to look at. And do that, you don't get, it's more like a smash and grab operation. There's a lot of issues there that come from the restrictions of doing this stuff legally rather than going to jail.
And to piggyback off of that, just for a moment, off of your first comment, off of Al's first comment, is basically that the one thing I guess I could say I don't dislike anything about red teaming in general, right? I do love the field. I do love my work. I do love the job. When I do red teaming, right? I will say one thing that really, really grinds my gears is in that scoping is when the organization doesn't have an open enough mind and they want you to chop down the tree. They do, but they don't want to they don't want any leaves to fall off the tree. And I've had that a couple of times over the years, a couple of times where I've just had to limit myself. And it's infuriating because you know yourself, you know your job, you know what you're trying to do. And it's like, look, dude, this guy, a true malicious actor is not going, frankly, to give a damn about whether or not any leaves fall off, like of this tree while I'm chopping it down. They're not going to care. But you have to, if you want to have continued business, you do have to, like kind of he said, it's a necessary evil. You have to adhere to those restrictions wherever they apply. And yeah, it grinds my gears, but, you know, it's not a perfect world.
Yeah, building strong relationships with clients, your coworkers, the white cell people, like these other teams that your workflow is involved with, building strong relationships with these other people will save you a ton of headaches.
I mean, I've seen them get more lenient over time. I mean, once we may or may not have serviced an organization for a couple of years, right? They may become a little more lenient, and we're actually a lot more quick at how we provide adequate reporting and so on and so forth.
So one particular thing, and it's a specific hook into what Al was talking about scoping. There is one particular part of scoping that tends to grind my gears a little bit, which is even if you set up a really well-defined scope that allows you lots of it's very permissive to what the red team can do, and you're off to the races and you're mid-operation and it's raining shells and you're having a great time. And this is very much influenced by the kind of organization that you're in. But then leadership will come down and say, "Hey, red team, what do you guys think about this like cloud thing? We want you to do something with this cloud thing. Go." And you're mid operation, or maybe at the end of an operation, and you're like, "We now have to like shove a whole bunch of objectives in on quote cloud thing, which we don't even like. They don't even know what they're asking us for. So now we got to kind of like pivot off of an objective and go move somewhere else." So that kind of mid operation scope changing can be very costly from like a personnel perspective, right? No one likes to have the leadership come down and say like, "Hey, I just read this very interesting article about something. Here's a very vague description of what I want. Go for it." That's fine at the beginning if you can kind of hash it out with them and be like, "Okay, talk to me about cloud thing. What does that mean to you?" If you're at the beginning of an operation, that's no problem. You can iron out those details and then you can launch a campaign against that. But like with 3 weeks to go in the operation and they're like, "Oh, we also want this to include this subset of something," that can be pretty, pretty annoying. That's about the worst it gets. Script Missile said, the kind of permissiveness of red teaming that you don't have to itemize a compliance checklist and send that up to the next tier up, and that gets lost for 3 months, and then somebody comes back and says, "Oh, the process has changed. I'm sorry, you have to re..." Like, none of that exists in the red team space. If you're documenting your procedures well and you can prove what you did, when you did it, and what effect it had, you're going to be fine as a red teamer. And that, like getting rid of a lot of that... that administrative burden is super liberating for what you can do with the time that you're given. But I don't like mid-campaign scope changes. That's about the worst it gets for me.
Dude, they're so bad.
Mm-hmm. Thirded.
Fourthed. All right, let's move on. This question says, "What is your choice of C2 and why do you prefer it?" And whoever is going to answer this first, I would kindly ask that you please explain what C2 is for the audience in case people aren't aware. So whoever wants to ask. Whoever wants to answer that, please go ahead.
Okay, well, everyone's going to say Cobalt Strike. But
what is your favorite and why is it Cobalt Strike?
Yeah, why is it Cobalt
Strike? That should be the question, I think.
I have a different answer to this, but I'll let Al talk first, but I have a different answer to this.
I'll quickly explain. C2 stands for command and control, you know, two words that start with C, hence C2. Command and control is your is sort of the way you're managing the entire engagement. It's this framework that you're using to control all the compromised hosts in the environment, essentially. So there are a number of solutions available for this. The most commonly known one and the most popular one commercially is Cobalt Strike. That being said, a license for Cobalt Strike, I think, is like $4,000 a year. They're not exactly cheap. So if you don't have a job as a red teamer and you want to play around with one of these C2 frameworks, you might find yourself in the unfortunate position of having to use Covenant or Silent Trinity or, God forbid, Meterpreter, or Sliver, or one of those other lesser known, or one of those other lesser known ones. There's quite a few of them floating around. Merlin's another good one, floating around, and those are adequate. I know I throw a little jab, little knives at them, but only because they don't stack up against the $4,000 option that my company pays for.
Yeah, right. So a few things in response to what Al just said. One, I'd be careful with calling Metasploit and Meterpreter a C2. One thing that you should do as a responsible red teamer is make sure that your payloads authenticate to your C2 server. Basically, if your payload, if you've, you know, months after the operation is cleaned up and maybe you just forgot to check in and delete one of those binaries that you dropped to disk, if like years from now that binary is still sitting there and somebody fires it off, you know, cyber criminal, malicious actor or otherwise, that might go somewhere and it might not. But if it's not authenticating, then it's like in a very weird fringe case scenario where somebody put up a Meterpreter or a multi-handler at a specific IP, they might be able to catch that shell. So you've got to be careful because Meterpreter by itself in its default configuration doesn't authenticate its check-ins. There is, I think, like a paranoid mode or something like that you can set it to, but it's not, it wasn't meant to be like a red team C2, right? So I would just be careful with that. But to the other point, yes, Cobalt Strike is the big one. It's what everybody uses, provided they have the funding for a license there. If you, and I want to make this useful to the people that are maybe thinking about, they want to be a red teamer, they want to start working with this stuff if they've never picked up a C2 before. If you have not picked up a C2 before, a few of the free ones are really good for trainers, i.e. they're good for understanding how these things work, how to set one up, how to generate payloads, how they check in, and how they function from, like, you know, a command is generated on the server, and it checks in, the agent checks in, grabs the command from the server, and then executes it and sends back whatever you want. So Covenant, I know Al makes jabs at Covenant, but Covenant was the first one that I picked up that I was like, oh, it clicked for me how these things work. It's an asynchronous communication between something that exists in the target environment and something that exists that you control. And that interaction is very interesting to look at. So pick, if you haven't picked up a C2 before, go check out Covenant and Empire. They're not, I would not use them operationally, but they are fantastic training wheel C2s. And they will get you. You have used Empire?
I've used Empire operationally. It works.
Nice. Nice.
It's adequate. So
yeah, they'll get you what you need to know to be fluent in. Just like when you pick up one programming language and then you switch to another one and all you really have to learn is the syntax of the new language. Once you get pretty good at one of these C2s, you'll be able to switch to Cobalt Strike and it'll just kind of make sense. Like, you'll be able to, like, use the default features and understand how to set them up, and then you're like, oh, and Cobalt Strike can do this and this and this, and then it starts to build from there. But the real one that I want to bring up here, which was my alternate answer to this, even more than Cobalt Strike right now, I'm loving Merlin. Neon Dog, if you're listening to this, you have made something incredible, and I feel like not enough people know about Merlin as a C2. It has fantastic, first of all, it's open source, completely free. It has fantastic network protocol setup and configurations. So the idea of Merlin is that there are, everybody knows about HTTP and HTTPS, but there are a few other network HTTP protocols that are not commonly understood or even looked for, and Merlin can use those for C2. H2C is one of these, HTTP3, quick UDP HTTP, which is all, like, I don't even understand how that works. I haven't looked into the white paper. But Merlin can use those as its channel to communicate back. All right, what does this mean for a red teamer? If you're in an environment and they don't know to look for HTTP traffic that is UDP, not TCP, you're invisible, effectively invisible. It's high risk, high reward, because if they do know to look for it, you're going to stand out like a sore thumb because nobody's using quick right now. But if they don't know to look for it, you might sail through your network. Traffic might sail through undetected, which is like incredible to think about. So I love Merlin. It's more like a scalpel, not really a jackhammer, right? Like Cobalt Strike is like a jackhammer. You'd use that thing to like break down the door and do all your daily driving. But Merlin is like a scalpel. It's very, very precise. You want to use it very precisely. But I love it. I've used it every day for on my operation that I'm currently in, and it's just so good.
Yeah, I agree. I had that same feeling about Silent Trinity for like the month after DEF CON 2019, when it was still viable. Bipe Leader was at, I was at his presentation where he revealed Silent Trinity in at DEF CON. I was like, holy shit, this is the new shit. And I used it for like two engagements for a month, and then antivirus started flagging on literally everything, so it ruined my day.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I highly recommend you experiment around with these other C2 frameworks, because they all have their pros and cons. Like Sliver, for example, will dynamically and procedurally generate all of the payloads, so they all look different and they're all obfuscated by design, which is pretty cool. But Cobalt Strike, you're gonna find, like, even the SolarWinds attackers. The SolarWinds attackers had their cute little supply chain custom backdoor or whatever, but they rarely use that. What they used for pivoting around in the environment was Cobalt Strike. They ran Cobalt Strike beacons, and because Cobalt Strike is just so reliable and so robust as far as its tool set, that it just there was really no substitute for it. Like, yeah, there are like all these C2 frameworks are good in certain. In certain conditions compared to the others, Cobalt Strike is the standout for sure.
Yeah, it's like the AK-47. You accept no substitutes.
Yeah,
Cobalt. It's the mainstay of the red teaming world for good reason. I think for good reason.
Well, if there's one thing that I'm learning today, and I will take from this, it's that Cobalt Strike is the AK-47 of cybersecurity. So thank you very much for that analogy. Guys, we are halfway through our time and we're not halfway through our questions. So going forward, I'm going to try to limit responses to two people, whoever feels most, you know, appropriate to answer the questions, just as a heads up. This next question asks, what is the easiest engagement you have been on and what was the most difficult engagement? Crustacean and whoever else feels they can answer, please give us your thoughts.
The easiest engagement I've ever been on was also the longest. So that lasted about 10 months, and I was just a, you know, stereotypical, like, start external, go internal, and then once you're internal, start finding the crown jewels, that style of engagement. The most difficult engagement that I've ever been on was not necessarily strictly a red team. It was more of like a pseudo pen test against a really small web app with a very small attack surface, and there was very little to find outside of like TLS findings, you know, maybe like vulnerable libraries, but it was like a low risk kind of vulnerability. Like there was really not a whole lot going on with this web app, and that was. Those smaller ones with the small attack surfaces are much more challenging than the larger engagements for me personally.
I would say my quickest engagement. That was your question, right? What was like the quickest engagement?
Your easiest and your most difficult, however you interpret it.
Okay, easiest, quickest. For an organization, my team went up against, we were authorized, we were greenlit, everyone was in position and ready to go. And we managed to compromise, give or take, about 20,000 machines within the span of 2 hours. And that was just pretty much, obviously, game over, right? So that was definitely the quickest. The most difficult, you're probably wondering how, right? The answer is that said organization had vulnerability assessment tools already running. And those vulnerability assessment tools were throwing around SSH keys or configured to validate SSH sessions. So it did not take long, is all I'm going to say there. But aside from that, the most difficult probably would have been back towards the start of 2020. And again, yet another unnamed organization. But we actually went through hell and high water just for logistics, months and months and months, because of COVID, to tell you the truth. We had everything planned for flights and everything until we could no longer fly. And it was like, well, we have to do this, right? This is compliance. We have to get there somehow. Thankfully, the stakeholders were able to call it off due to COVID. But that was like sweaty palms for sure. And it was pretty difficult. From a logistics standpoint, at least.
Yeah, I can imagine. So thanks for sharing, guys. Moving on swiftly to our next question. This one's interesting because it asks, how often do you participate in physical engagements? And is there any standardized equipment that you use for them? I'm not sure if any of you guys, you know, actively do physical engagements. So whoever does or might have some expertise and insight, please feel free to educate us.
Mine all dried up with COVID. I was doing them semi-frequently before COVID. But by semi-frequently, I mean I'd have like 2 to 3 a year. But then COVID happened and we stopped doing anything in person. And I haven't done one since. And it's like a void in my life. It's like a gap. I stay awake at night going, I want to socially engineer. I want to go in with I want to go up to the reception desk in my Time Warner shirt. Or my hard hat and reflective vest can ask to use the restroom and so on and so forth. It's a constant struggle. But I wouldn't say that there's any standardized equipment. It all depends on your target. You have to case the joint. You know, like in any heist movie you've seen, you gotta case the joint and assess the security and then develop a plan. Your equipment is going to vary wildly depending on what gets the job done.
Great, thanks, Al. Does anyone else have any more feedback on physical engagements?
I have never done one, actually, so I have to pass on this one.
I've never done one from the adversarial perspective, but I've done many, many base defense exercises when I was in the Air Force, kind of seeing physical kind of pseudo assessments. They have a totally different direction.
Yes.
But
yes. Like, can we take out this power supply with, you know, this size of a bullet, you know, and you know what I mean, from this distance, just to prove, you know, or to show or demonstrate, you know, how much we could impact your entire infrastructure, right? But like, we got somebody out of a building. Those physical ones are much more rare. I do know a person in the field that I'm not going to name that is very skilled at this, and I've had many talks with this individual. And they end up just becoming a lot more like problem solvers, right? It becomes a lot more like this organization has a massive hole, a massive thing that they're willing to admit about, right? It's from a physical perspective, a risks that could happen. And if we can achieve the same effect and bring it all down with a single bullet, like literally a single bullet, then, you know, our point is made.
You guys are firing weapons in physical assessments? Oh my God.
The context for me was seeing it from the other side, right? So just kind of looking at it, right? You want to look for doors where there aren't security guards, cameras pointed at the door or near or around the door. You know, if you've ever played Metal Gear Solid as a kid, a lot of the same kind of like tactics I imagine would work, right? You got blind spots under cameras, door sensors, all of this. There's a ton of stuff that you need to take into consideration, like what Al was saying.
Hiding in a crate.
Can I just sit for a second for the chat? I'm so sorry. I do not advocate for bringing weapons on premises. Please. This is very specialized physical engagement. I'm not advocating for this at all, man.
I was listening to this. This is nuts.
we talked about this scoping thing. Like some organizations want the scope to be so restrictive you can't even murder security guards. Like it's like what it's like they don't want this to be hit. It's like they don't want this to be Hitman.
No, it's insane. No, I do not advocate for the usage of weapons on these physical engagements, guys. I'm just saying it was a special case.
I also do not advocate for weapons on engagements. Not a good idea.
No, obviously I was being facetious. It's not a good idea. Okay. Just very obviously don't want anyone to get hurt. But yeah, I can talk more about physical engagements if you'd like, or we can move on to the next question. I know that's
something area, a lot there's of people a lot of stories. Hear about. Yeah, there's a lot of stories. Yeah.
I got stories, but there's too many to tell right now.
Too many. But...
All right, let's move on from our guns inside of buildings conversations. No. That seems like the apt thing to do right now. I'm sorry, I know. Listen, I bet most of you want to hear more of Crab and Siren stories, but as the host, I have responsibilities of moving things along, and I take that seriously. So, Husky and Owl, please let me know, what is your normal working schedule? Do you work 9 to 5? How many hours a week do you normally end up working?
Effectively 9 to 5, not those hours specifically. I work a little earlier in the day. And I try to keep right to 40 hours. I'm very, very protective of my free time. The deal I go into with my management is I sit down at my start time. I work the whole time. A lot of jobs, like you'll come in and you'll sit down and do 3 hours of work and then just kind of like look around and browse Reddit and stuff for the remainder of the time. I am programming, weaponeering, scouting, recon for my actual working hours. Like I'm not like hanging around. I do take breaks once in a while. And I take a lunch break, but I'm not like just idly looking at the wall while I'm at work. I straight up will be working on projects, developing capabilities, doing recon the whole time that I'm at work. But then at the end of my day, I am like, I shut my laptop down and I say goodbye. Don't talk to me after this. I'm going to go work on, I'm going to go have a personal life and work on my personal projects. In rare instances, if it's like 15 minutes to the end of the day and we get a shell and the webhook for the shell check-in kicks off and I get a little notification that says that a shell just popped, I will say a little bit later than that just to make sure that agent is delivered correctly and we're on target and we are who we think we are and we are where we think we are. But that's it. Like I'll stay a little bit later for that if that happens, but I'm incredibly protective of my free time. Because that's just from like a philosophy perspective, that's why we do this work, right? We do it because we love it, but we also do it so that we can live a life that we want to live. So yeah, I'm very protective of my free time. I try not to work more than 40 hours. It's a rare instance that I do.
I mean, I'm kind of the I'm kind
and are
of the
you the same
extreme.
Al?
No, I'm not at all. I think this highlights like the flexibility of the job, right? So a lot of the job is just it gives you that freedom to be flexible about when you want to work. I'm big on if the work gets done, you shouldn't have to worry about when and how I did it. And that's I often put in hours in the middle of the night. Just because that's when I do my best work. I'm not really a strict 9-to-5-er. I like to be able to be flexible and accomplish things that are not work during my workday. During the stereotypical boomer workday. As long as my job gets done, the engagement gets completed, you shouldn't care if I did it in the middle of the night or if I did it early in the morning or when I accomplished it is the point I'm trying to get at. But I understand what that leads to problems from time to time. Like I sometimes feel like I don't really have any free time because I'm always kind of working off and on. So it gets difficult to separate your real life from your normal personal life from your job. So I can understand why Husky has that very strict divide, and he keeps them so satiated, but I've just never been that disciplined. I guess that's just my separate approach to it.
That makes sense. Thank you guys. I appreciate it. Now this next question is going to be for Siren and Crab. And that question is, what kind of skill spread exists within your team? Do you have positions such as malware devs, expert phishers, etc.? What does your team skill set look like?
Yeah, easy question to answer, but I want to preface all of what I'm about to say with, this is not applied to offensive security. This is applied to a red team I was with before offensive security. So as long as we have that out of the gate, then I can say my old team, we did have very specialized roles or things that we were really good at. Like I said, my boss was an ex-Navy SEAL, and he was looking for very specific people in very specific areas. One such individual was like administrative logistics, hardware, having things ready to be deployed in a facility such that when the laptop lid is opened, the rest of the team is ready to go. Another person was one of the top members, he will remain unnamed, from HackerOne. I'm sure many people listening right now are familiar with that bug bounty platform, but he was pretty much a star on there as far as cross-site scripting findings went. And we had him on our team, and he was like the XSS king, man. The things this guy found so quickly, it blew my mind, it blew everybody's mind. So he was definitely there, and we would save those, we'd save those for those internal assessments, right? Which brings me into my next guy on the team, also unnamed. He had the cool job of planning out attack campaigns, phishing campaigns, continuous, persistent campaigns. So he would be sitting there waiting for months for, you know, a single XSS to trigger, right? And then, have plans and ready and everything for all of us to move forward from there. My job in particular, I specialized with the web surface. Internal, external, flat, plain and simple. When it came to findings on the web, I was working very closely with that XSS king that I was talking about. Aside from that, then we had our reporting guy. This guy was... Because we didn't want to have to, our boss didn't want us to have to divert our focus unless it was absolutely necessary. So that's why we had that central platform, right, for notation, what we were doing and what our results were for that day. And what we would do is kind of like collect all that information. And this guy's particular role was to take all of that, formulate it in the type of report that the organization wanted. And these could result in 200, 300 page long technical reports, right? And that was his job. So we had, you're totally right. We all had our own specialties. We all had our own, you know, tricks of the trade that we were particularly good at. And that would conclude it there for me.
As far as for the team that I'm on, at the moment it's just me and another guy. We used to have three. COVID kind of changed that in weird ways, but we have a very good spread. So my direct coworker, he's very good with like the back end infrastructure. So like building up C2, knowing where to put stuff, under certain circumstances, would it be better to do domain fronting or redirectors? He has very, very strong tradecraft knowledge on that front. I have very good social engineering skills. I'm somewhat okay at web. So, I mean, like, by and large, we have most of the bases covered between the two of us, but that also introduces some kind of workflow, kind of operations tempo issues for us. So we're usually playing catch up because of that.
Interesting. Thank you, Siren and Crab. That was very insightful. Going back to Al and Husky, your question is, and I hope you can give some good resources for this, but it asks, how do you stay ahead of the game and remain knowledgeable? Do you read any particular news sites, follow any particular Twitters, etc.? So please enlighten us on the best resources for staying up to date.
I think you're probably expecting some kind of Giga 5 head super secret red team site that that tells you all the new tools and new tradecraft and stuff. And I'm just going to say Reddit. Reddit is like 90% of it. Our NetSec is super good. Our red team sec is also super good. And then for news sites, I have a variety of blogs that I follow. Like Krebs on Security, that one's really good. Bleeping Computer, I showcase that one on stream quite a bit. And then there's a number of GitHub repos that I follow. Husky hit one earlier, Offensive NIM. That's, you just kind of got to keep your finger on the pulse. There's no one place you can look at. Although I'd say if there was one place you could look at to keep your finger on the pulse, it would be Reddit.
I agree with that. Yeah. So Reddit's a big one. So Al's got the news covered, like news sources that's like Bleeping Computer, Ars Technica. The other half of that is communities that you can join and talk to other red teamers and trade, talk shop and trade craft. So Bloodhound Gang Slack, really good. Lots of like prodigious developers are in the Bloodhound Gang Slack. The people that are writing the tools that you're using to perform things on effect on the target, the developers are probably going to be in there. If you have a question, try to read the documentation first, but if the documentation doesn't have the answer to it, you could ask them directly. I mentioned Merlin earlier. He, Neon Dog, the dev of Merlin, is in the Bloodhound Gang Slack in its own special channel in Merlin. And I was doing some work to make a custom Merlin agent, and I was like, hey, I've got some questions about how I could approach this. We hashed it out. I opened up a couple issues on his repo, and then we worked it out, and I was able to, you know, meet the intention of what I was going for. My point is, these people are not like, they're not like Hightower cloistered, you know, developers that don't ever come out and say hi to anybody. Like, they're like working on their projects and they're available in most cases to talk to you about it. If you have questions, try to respect their time, try to answer the questions first to your own ability if you can. But if you have some kind of, you know, more specific question about their tools, ask them in those slacks. They're, you know, in my instances, they've been very responsive with getting back to me about things. So yeah, I would say go find those communities, Bloodhound Gang, trying to think, some of the other, red team discords. This is a good one. Go read the news and then go talk to people, I guess would be my two points there.
Thank you both. I have another, considerably spicy question, and this is for Crab and Siren. And, this question asks, how do you make sure you do not cause any downtime or disruption in prod environments? Let me just point out that I think it's very bold of them to assume that you've never caused any disruption in a prod environment.
Right. This answer is legitimately pretty quick. I actually talked about this yesterday on my stream. The answer, short and simple, is to mimic the network. So we're all, you know, pretty well versed in TCP/IP network infrastructure. I believe that in this field, it should be mentioned that you should have a good background with that. If you encounter denial of service conditions in a production environment, or what could be potential, a denial of service conditions, you have a couple of responsibilities as a red teamer. One, to notify stakeholders that A, this even exists in the first place. That becomes an effective remediation, is just to let them know how they can fix it quick. I've seen denial of services that have been as quick as literally just connecting to a
netcatting into a service, and it blew our mind that it was even capable of having a dash D command, which would take it down, right? But that being said, the best thing you can do and the simplest thing you can do is mimic in a private environment, mimic the network infrastructure, show what the, then go ahead and carry out the denial of service condition on your network, on your private network, on your constructed network, and demonstrate, oh, oops, I can no longer access this server or service, or even entire, you know, span of hosts. It could be a whole class C. It could be a class B. But those are, the point is you wanna be able to mimic and deploy these things quick, which is why it's useful to have this kind of infrastructure ready to go. I mentioned this earlier that, you know, we had specific roles and so on and so forth. One of our guys' specific roles was to have network infrastructure of an organizational caliber ready to go. And these could be very lightweight machines. We even had like multiple server racks and like that were pretty much kind of like underground for this very purpose, so that we could deploy, be it with scripts or whatever, an entire network that simulates the distributions, kernels, running firmware, stuff like that, and then carry out the attack on our network and show literally what the output or what the end result would be for the organization, and include that in our formal report to say, hey, this is what could have happened. So I'll leave that one there.
Yeah, and so coming from someone who has by accident taken out a civilian airport and three military bases doing very, very like non-intrusive, just basic network management tasks.
Oh my God.
When you screw up on that level, attention to detail becomes a very important life skill for you. So Siren is absolutely correct. You want to be spinning up labs. You want to be testing your tooling. You want to be absolutely sure that if you're going to use something in an environment beforehand, that you have a reasonable like expectation or a reasonable probability of things going well or things going wrong before you actually do it. I don't think anybody is going to argue against that. You should be building up labs and you should be testing your tooling before you actually use it. Now, that being said, mistakes happen. There are poor engineering decisions that are made in environments. You might come across a system that's naturally unstable. You might try and just make a request, and then that request turns into like 20,000 requests by some weird network issue. That's not your fault, and those things happen. It's just, you know, ensuring that you have good communication with stakeholders, good communication with the white cell, and just doing your best to stay inside the realms of the scope. You should be fine.
Man, oh man, you guys heard it here today, talking about comparing Cobalt Strike to AK-47s and taking out civilian airports. So, you know, don't say it wasn't an interesting AMA.
Let's take it in context. Please add context to what you just said.
Yeah, context, please. All right, we're coming to the end of our AMA, which I know is so unfortunate, but there's one question that was asked, and I think it's going to be one that's really important to everyone listening in. So I want to open it back up to all of the panelists. And that question is, how does someone begin to get into red teaming? And is there anything essential for a resume that you would recommend in order to become a red teamer? Basically, any pro tips about getting into red teaming. So whoever wants to answer, please go for it.
I mean, I give them all the time on my stream. The best way to get into it is, first of all, to show an interest to your boss, like to display to your at your place of work. So if you're in some kind of a cybersecurity role already, then you want to display, hey, I want to like work more in adversary emulation. I want to do more red teaming type stuff, and then they can point. They can, if there are positions like that at your job, they can start considering you for those. And also considering you for things like certifications that could be good to further your education in the field, and so on and so forth. You don't want to be tight-lipped at your job about your plans for self-improvement. You want to make sure that they know what your goals are so that they can try to keep you happy. So that's the first thing I would recommend. Second thing I'd recommend is by participating in the community. Like Husky was talking about earlier, as to be a red teamer requires is essentially just like you have to be involved in the community. You have to sort of embrace the team part of the red team. Like you have to no one can know any one thing. So the collaboration becomes very important. Discord, Slack, all that stuff is super good for being involved in the community and getting a sense for, you know, modern tradecraft and how you can, what direction you can go in to learn. So that's number two. The number third thing I'd say, and the least important of all these things, is to get certifications that have to do with red teaming. And the reason I say it's least important is because the majority, even in those certifications, the majority of your learning is going to happen when you're just tinkering and playing around and familiarizing yourself with the work you're doing. So if you can do that for free, like without having to do a certification, then that's most of the battle right there. As far as getting a job in the field, certifications will help you though. The fourth thing I would say is specifically to focus on is Active Directory. Start learning Active Directory. Stop being afraid of it. And there you go. Husky, what do you got?
So if you guys know who Nardwar is, he is this very interesting character. He's a journalist, and he specializes in doing interviews with musicians. And he's got this, like, you got to go watch videos of him because he's just got this incredible energy. And like, he's got this, like, this panache for life almost. That's really, like, it's rare to see in people these days. But anyway, he's got this wonderful, he did a TED talk where he was talking about this concept of do it yourself. And he's talking about all of these opportunities that he was granted because, and he just keeps repeating this. He says, why was I given this? Because I asked. Al nailed it. If you have an inclination for this stuff, if you want to start to get into this stuff, find in your sphere of influence, find where the red teamers are operating and start to collaborate with them. Be like, I would like to come along on an operation. I want to see how you guys are working. That's how I got kind of into my particular role right now. I want to stress this, you don't have to be a pen tester to become a red teamer. You're listening to a person that is the case for. I was not a pen tester before I got my first operational, my first RTO position. So ask around, find in your sphere of influence where you can start to build projects, start to develop things on a GitHub, and put that out into the community. Yes, the other part of that for certifications, I got to shout out Rasta. Rasta Mouse has just released his updated CRTO course, or the course itself is called Red Team Operator. It's been updated. It's got fantastic content now, including a fully licensed Cobalt Strike server that you get for the full duration of the course itself. You can't take it with you. It's very important. You can't take it with you, but you can use it fully licensed the whole time. And that will get you hands-on with the tools that red teamers use. If you can do that, if you can start building, developing projects, if you can start networking with the people that are doing the operations, and then you can start going after certifications and learning kind of the tradecraft and the tools of the trade, you're going to be fine. You're going to find a great position.
Yeah. I would also say, I mean, it doesn't, let's maybe shout out the obvious. It's not going to hurt you. If you want to be a red teamer, it's not going to hurt you to have your OSCP and to have your OSEP. Those kind of certifications for hiring managers are stupid crucial for vetting and so on and so forth. Because taking somebody who's an OSCP, taking somebody who's an OSEP, and moving them on to a red team is super quick. You know what I mean? It's a super quick process. So I just want to put in my two cents there as well.
Fab, did you have any comments about getting into red teaming or pro tips on crafting a resume that will help you get into red teaming, or should we move on to the next question?
I will end this with a very quick little bit of life advice. Don't wait for people to notice you, because you might be waiting a very long time. Do things so that people won't ignore you, right? So find bugs, do disclosures, put out projects on GitHub, like what Husky was saying. Do these things that red teamers are doing and make it so that these people can't ignore you. Mm. That's all I've got.
Very good. Incredible advice right there.
Wow, that was really poignant advice coming from a crab. Man, I'm impressed. Okay. I really shouldn't laugh at my own jokes, but that's thoughtful. We'll move on. We have two more questions. They're pretty succinct questions, so whoever feels like they can best answer them, speak up. The question is, do you modify any open source tools to prevent detection? The example they give is Mimikatz.
Yes.
It's not just Mimikatz. I mean, any binary.
Oh, anything. You got it. You cannot. I alluded to this when I was answering, like, is there software development in red teaming? If you're not developing, if you're not changing open source tools, you're at the whims of the developers that are putting it. Let you in on a little secret. The developers know that once they put their tools out and they put a precompiled binary out there, it's going to be signatured immediately. They know that. They put those binaries out as proofs of concept. And then the implication is that if you're a red team operator, you're going to take that and you know, you can't just eat the cake. You got to rebake the cake, right? You can't just pull it out of the fridge and eat it immediately. You've got to rebake it. So they know what they're doing when they put out their source code on GitHub. They know that it's going to be signatured. You have to, if you're not developing custom tools, you're at the whims of the people that are signaturing those open source binaries.
Any further comments on that from the crowd, or was that just so poignantly answered by Husky that we can move on to the last question?
I mean, it's a really simple question. Yes, you would. I mean, obviously, you don't want to just be running. It's bad OPSEC to just sort of like slam out seatbelt in the target environment. Even seatbelt is going to get caught by Windows Defender these days. But I find it if you just change the CLS ID in it, it gets. You don't even have to really do development. This isn't really a development thing. You're just going in and you're like, there are plenty of tools out there that you can use. Rostamouse's Threat Check is a good one that will test your binary against antivirus products. And find out where roughly the signature is. This is a process basically of, it's an automated process when you're using one of those tools, but basically all you're doing is splitting the binary in half, and you're seeing if the signature is in the beginning or the end, and then you just repeat that process for wherever this, until you find the specific part of the binary where the signature is located. IPsec has a great video on this topic where he does it with Mimikatz. He obfuscates Mimikatz to get past Windows Defender. And he does this by splitting Mimikatz in half numerous times, and then into fourths, and then into, you know, until he finds the specific shard of the Mimikatz binary that is flagging, and then he modifies it. Then he modifies that binary, like removes some malicious string from it, or changes the way the function calls are being done. To avoid flagging antivirus.
He changes the compiler. He changes the way it's compiled, and that gets by it. Now, that was back in the day, but it just goes to show you it doesn't take a lot. It just takes a little bit of know-how.
It's not even development. Again, like with Seatbelt, all you need to do is change the CLS ID, and it's going to get past most things. Like that's as simple as changing a number inside of the and then recompiling it. That's it. To not do this is A, lazy, and B, just poor OPSEC. I think that's all that really needs to be said on it, unless you got more to say, Husky.
No, nailed it.
Great. That brings me to our very last question, which ironically was not asked by anyone in the audience. Rather, it's a Meg created question because I'm selfish, and when in the presence of brilliance, I want to ask questions. And that question is, to end us off, why red teaming over blue teaming? And have you ever considered or partaken in blue teaming?
I come from a blue team background. I come from a land down under. I come from a blue team background. I was an embedded analyst at MIT basically like a one-man sock in the watchtower. And I was waking up in the middle of the night with like cold sweats because I was like, how do I defend a network if I don't even know how to attack it? Which is a very reductive way to think. You don't have to know how to attack a network to know how to defend it. But at the time, that was my take. That led me, I don't think you should think that today, let me be clear. That led me down a path of learning how networks are attacked. And I've just never, ever wanted to go back. It is one of the coolest, most interesting jobs on Earth, that you get to play the enemy for the greater good of the defenders. I was in Al and I were actually playing Backdoors and Breaches last night, and I hadn't really thought about this, but the way you play Backdoors and Breaches is you role play as an incident response team. And I was like, oh geez, like it's been a while. Like I don't know a lot of how to administer these tools, and I'm not going to have a lot to add. And as we started playing, I realized how far I've come in my blue team capabilities simply by being a red teamer. So yeah, I come from a strong blue team background, but like now that I'm here, I'm probably never going back. It really is a dream job in a lot of ways. It's not perfect. It never will be, and it depends on where you are. But the actual work, the craftspersonship you get to do, combined with the creativity of being a red teamer, combined with the technical aspects of being able to program, it scratches so many itches for, like, if you love learning, if you love teaching things to people, if you're very programmatically minded, there's so many ways that you can approach it.
I would just say I enjoyed the raw sexual ferocity. Girls love bad boys. We're the bad boys of the nerds.
Oh, boy. See, Al got his Twitch partnership, and ever since he's, you know, been throwing around sentences like that. But that's, we'll move on.
To be fair, I think having a temperament kind of inclined to cause a little bit of trouble, you obviously don't want to cause a ton of trouble, right? But if you're a little bit of a troublemaker, like I am, you're probably going to be more valuable on a red team, just by nature of the job. You don't want to be on a blue team and have a temperament like myself, where you're constantly thinking, you know, what kind of risk can I take today? What can I experiment with? You know, sometimes that's encouraged on blue teams, but it's, in my opinion, I feel like the personal temperament that I've always had has either been more inclined with like a military career or something related to some kind of adversary action in a defense space like cybersecurity. I've really never had any other interests aside from this.
Great. So, Siren, did you have any comments, or can we end it here?
We can go ahead and end that there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much to Husky, Siren, our crustacean friend Crab, as well as Al. All of them, I believe, have really fantastic and informational social media channels. So if you just, you know, do the quick googly search, I'm sure you can find them. Other than that, I hope this was an informational session for everyone. It will be, well, it has been recorded, and it'll be up on the InfoSec Prep podcast sooner, hopefully, rather than later. And thank you for attending. I hope you guys have a great weekend, and we'll see you at the next AMA.
Thank you so much for having us. This is so much
fun.
Thank you, Meg.
Thanks for hosting. Being such a great host.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks, guys.